Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Off the Post. I'm Russ Cohen. We've got Anthony Mangione, and you would think the hockey news would start to slow down, but nope, not really.
Why in the name of God would it be? We're in the middle of Stanley Cup Finals, Russ.
Yeah, but usually, like, everything else sort of calms down, and it's not, and,
oh,
you know, I'm back from the Combine. That was interesting.
Other than the Stanley Cup Final. Yeah, that's true. I would agree with you on that. That's, you'd think things maybe would quiet down a little bit, but.
I mean, normally the focus would just be on that, and now it's on so many other things. But, you know, like, the one thing that I will say, and I don't know if I'm in favor of this, there are teams putting out a lot of, like, positive spin right now, and I'm thinking, don't you want to wait till after the Stanley Cup for that? Because your team's home watching, and I don't know if fans are ready for a positive spin on how good your team is right now while the season's still going on, and they're waiting to crown a champion.
It is an interesting perspective, but anymore, I mean, teams, I mean, if you think about it, people, all fans have already turned the page and are trying to, they're watching this final, which has been a really good final so far.
I mean,
even at times when the skill, you know, even at times when you play a sort of, you know, had moments of where it sputtered, for the most part, the flow has been excellent. These are the two obvious best teams in the NHL, and certainly you want the focus to be on those teams. But anymore, we're on a we're on a constant cycle. And fans of teams want constant information, so teams are going to try to put out that information. Of course, they're going to try to put as much of a positive spin as possible to say, hey, maybe our teams are going to be maybe a little bit closer to the two teams we're watching in the finals right now than we think. And, again, public relations are a key part of the game here, and whatever good information that they can get out to the fans, that's what they're going to try to do.
I suppose. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to bring in Chris Peters right now from CBS, and we'll talk about a lot of different things. Chris, how are you tonight?
I'm doing well, guys. How are you?
Real good, real good. So what do you think about what we were just saying, how teams are putting out all this positive spin right now while the season's still going on and the Stanley Cup hasn't been – nobody's hoisted it yet, and, you know, teams that have lost and been eliminated or been eliminated for weeks are like, hey, but look, we've got this positive spin for you.
Yeah, well, I guess – if there's one thing that the TV ratings tell us about the Stanley Cup final is that the fans of other teams are not watching the way that they do in other sports. So that's part of the problem with the ratings. I think, you know, we've seen that time and time again where, you know, you obviously get the big numbers from the local markets, and then, you know, there are only a few markets that really follow the game. The games as you know, passionately, I guess, as others, but I mean, Buffalo being one of them, every year they seem to be up in the top. So I think these teams need to provide information to their fan bases to keep them engaged. However they do it, you know, teams that have brought in new coaches, they have some optimism to kind of put out there. Teams that are going to have rookies that are exciting next season, you know, they want to start plugging those guys. So you have to keep your fan base engaged. I think that's kind of the way that social media and the internet age works. People are looking for that content, and teams are happy to provide it because it, you know, it keeps their name in the news. And the only people that are going to do that is the teams themselves, because everybody's moved on from covering them for a season, and they want to enjoy their off season. So those teams have to put that content out there by themselves.
If other teams right now making the news while the Stanley Cup Finals going on, what's going on in Glendale right now is just enough to make your head spin. What's going on between the Coyotes and the city right now? Just kind of, what are your current sort of thoughts on that right now as to what exactly is happening over there?
Well, I think, you know, the city council was looking for any possible way to get this. To make this happen, and I'm not sure what the election cycle's like. I'm not sure, you know, those things. But to me, you know, it basically the city council changed enough where people that didn't vote for it, that didn't want the Coyotes there, were there. And I understand it's a city trying to protect its interests, and but this was a deal that was voted on fairly, legally, and based on the limited information that we have about why the contract was voided, it seems pretty flimsy. You know, so I think that the Coyotes have every right to fight this with all the legal might that they can. The league has the right to support them. I think that, that if anything, the latest information that has come out of the ownership group has been pretty much that they want to stay, that they want to be there. And I think, you know, I don't know how this is going to get resolved, if there's going to be some sort of settlement, if there's, you know, apparently the restraining order against the city has been granted by the judge, so that means that the team can continue kind of operating as they'd like to. We're still waiting on, I think, officially the court dates and everything like that. So this is going to play out probably over the next month. The Coyotes aren't going to be able to sign any free agents because who the heck is going to want to sign a team that may not, you know, have a home, they don't know what's going on. But, you know, my thought is I think that there should be a team there. I think that this ownership group needs to have an opportunity to make it work there. If it doesn't work with them, they're the last chance, really. I mean, it's the last chance for the Coyotes, and you move them on if you have to. But I think that this ownership group has done a lot of things well, and we see that in, you know, the youth hockey numbers are growing there. I think since they came in, there are a lot of other things happening that are positive. And they're trying to do it the right way, I believe. And obviously the product on the ice isn't great right now and won't be next year, especially given this whole thing that's happening right now. But it's just a really confusing time. And I think that based on what the city council is trying to avoid this deal on, I just don't see it as strong enough. And I'm not a legal expert, but it just seems to me that they're really reaching here.
You know, here's the thing. The more I talk about this, the more I'll get negative tweets. But From the city's perspective, look, you're right. What you're saying is absolutely right. But from their perspective, it's like, hey, we're subsidizing this. We're giving like $15 million a year, and the best you could do is lose us $7 million a year. And there's still businesses dying around that place. I get reports all the time from people that I know that live there. And at the end of the day, it's not creating other jobs other than keeping some people working at the arena. So there's that. And then the fans are upset because, hey, they get cheap seats. They don't want to miss out on that, and I get that. But it's not enough of a core. And it hasn't been enough of a core. I went back and looked at 2002, 2003 before they moved. They were still ranked 29th. But then if I bring that up, it's like, well, that place was horrible and it's bad for hockey. Okay, well, then you got a better place, but it was too far away. So now you want another place. I'm in the camp that you can't give them another place, whether it's with the Phoenix Suns or not. It's just too much. No teams get this many chances. But we'll see. We'll see how it plays out. It is going to hurt them for this year, and they may go through what, like the Montreal Expos went through, in that while all this is going on, if fans think they're leaving, they may not show up at all.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I mean, I think that this is, you know, who's going to want to buy season tickets and who's going to want
right.
to do any of that? Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. And I agree with you, too, about all the deal being bad for the city. Unfortunately, that's the deal they voted on, and that's the one
right.
that they agreed to. And now they're going really a back alley way of trying to get rid of it. And I think that's fine. City officials need to do what's best for their community. They need to do what's best with the taxpayers' money. I get that. I just think that this is such a reach based on the limit, and this is based on the limited info we have. If they have more that we don't know, then yeah, I mean, I would love to hear it, but at this point, it just seems, you know, and it's unfortunate. I mean, obviously, the timing couldn't be worse, and it's not that much fun.
Chris, if we're looking at the situation with Arizona and they do sort of exhaust options here, I know there's been a lot of scuttlebutt with regards to potential other places that the franchise could move. I know the NHL would obviously prefer expansion to Las Vegas if it gets to that. Do you think that is a possible recourse for them, that instead of expansion could, in terms of trying to keep the Western Conference's, I guess you could say, their numbers, where they're at right now in terms of numbers of teams, is that a possibility in your mind, that the guys could possibly be there? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if there's no other options, and I think that the NHL would choose Phoenix if that was the alternative. You know, to relocating to a new city, and they may have to do that even in the short term. If this whole thing with Glendale doesn't get resolved and they can't use the facility next season, or it's going to be something where the facility is going to get ripped out from under them in the middle of the season, then, you know, I think that they really would only have the option of trying to fill the, you know, playing in Phoenix for a year as a holdover and then moving on. Because really right now their only other option relocation-wise in terms of a building that's ready for next season is Quebec City. And
unless there's Kansas City, we know that Gary Bettman's got that friend in Kansas City.
That is true. That is very true. And that would be incredibly interesting. And maybe they decide that, hey, this is a good time to test that market. But, you know, that would be really crazy, too. And who knows what would happen. But, yeah, I mean, I think the NHL is going to do whatever they possibly can to stay in Arizona. And if it doesn't work out, then they are going to have to move somewhere. And I think all of the options that are available, we know that, you know, Vegas will be done by next season or the season after next, and they have options. So we'll see. But Seattle's not one of them yet. So,
no.
So, yeah, well, that'll be interesting.
Yeah, we'll switch it out, though. Let's talk a little draft. And, you know, there's so much talk online, and I'm pumping out some articles lately for CSM Philly. And, boy, some of the talk, I just hate when some fans are like, well, this guy's a waste of a pick. And it's like, come on, this draft is a pretty great draft, and let's not call somebody who might get picked in the top 10 or 12 picks a waste of a pick. That's kind of rough. But I like the passion from a lot of different fan bases, because there's so much more focus now on the draft than when I started covering it in 2001, because it's so important to a team, because of the salary cap and other reasons. And so now, I would say in the last 2 or 3 years, and since social media has really hit big, the draft is, like, huge on social media, it seems.
Yeah, it is. I mean, this is – because I started covering the draft independently in 2010. So, you know, I think even in the 5 years since then, it's grown – amazingly. I mean, and part of it's social media. Part of it is the fact that these kids are on TV all the time now. You can get them on NHL Network and NBC Sports. That's huge. So, I mean, that, and to me, that's great, because it means that it's exposing people to other levels of hockey. They're watching college hockey. They're watching junior. You know, they're watching the world juniors. So, to me, this has been a lot of fun, because it's really been great to watch it grow. And I think the niche content within a niche sport is a good thing. I'm surprised that it's really taken off the way that it has over these last couple of years.
Chris, if you're looking in terms of some of the prospects that we've spoken in the past about Noah Hanifan, and obviously you've got you know, your views on him are very high, as are many NHL teams. But I know there's been also a lot of talk about Ivan Provorov. Again, if we're talking about the high end of the draft with regards to defensive prospects, even though forwards seem to be the ones that seem to be getting talked about more. If you sort of are comparing, contrasting guys like Provorov or Werenski with Hanifan in terms of where you see them maybe shaking out, is there a possibility that a Provorov, I know there have been some sort of scuttlebutt about potentially Provorov maybe moving up further in the first round than people originally think. Perhaps Werenski might be a little bit further up, and that the gap between Hanifan and those two is really not as wide as people may think it might be.
Yeah, well, I've had a chance to watch these guys quite a bit. Even Provorov when he was at Cedar Rapids in the USHL last year, and I just can't see anybody, any defenseman being drafted ahead of Noah Hanifan. You know, I go back to the draft. I go back to the 94 birth years where, you know, we had Jacob Trouba and Seth Jones, and we were all talking, we'll never see a duo like that again. And a couple years later, it's Hanifan and Werenski, and they're playing college hockey at 17 years old. So, you know, I just think the maturity level for Hanifan is there. He has offensive instincts. I think that his production was a little bit slower than we thought it would be this year. But, again, he's a 17-year-old playing college hockey, so I'm going to give him, you know, grade him on a curve a little bit there. But it's just he's the total package. Provorov, I think there's a lot of high-end skill. He's got a lot of puck-moving abilities. You know, he does have a really good shot, and I think, you know, he's still getting there. He has a lot of upside. He's still figuring out what kind of player he's going to be in the long term. And then Werenski is kind of this, you know, he's kind of a wild card. I think, you know, watching him his first few games at Michigan and watching him at the end of the season, it was, and watching him at the World Juniors, I just thought it was a great maturation process for him. He rounded out his game so much more. I think early on he was just puck to the net, puck to the net, puck to the net, and I think he showed a lot more patience as the season wore on, and particularly at the World Juniors, I was really impressed with the way that he played. Needs to work in the defensive zone still. There's still plenty of work there. He's in a good spot to do that if he stays at Michigan, although I did hear that there was he's open to the possibility of possibly going to London next year, which would be an interesting move, going from college hockey to that, which could potentially work out just fine. You never know. But he's a really good offensive defenseman. I still think, I would still slot them Hanifin, Provorov, Werenski in that order. And I to me, at least, the gap between Hanifin and those two is large.
Yeah, the thing is, Chris, I think I would slot them the same way, too, and I do have them slotted that way, even in my updated rankings, which I'll have out after my last draft show hits this weekend. But I think the issue is, if there's a team out there that wants to insert Provorov this year in the NHL, he's the guy that's more ready than the other two, obviously. And, you know, if you look at, like, Hanifin, he's played, like, 50 or 60 less games, and that's just because of the college schedule and everything else. So that would be the only thing that would mark against him. But I think the thing that Hanifin has working against him in the media is just that he's not like Bobby Orr to watch. And that's not his fault. He does everything well. He really does. And he does some things well that haven't really even been shown enough, like his point shot and things like that. But it seems like everybody is just looking for this flash when we talk about a great defenseman or someone worthy of being picked that high. And if you're like just sort of like a buy-the-book defenseman with some great attributes, it's almost like not good enough. And I think that's where maybe there's this feeling. But I don't think teams feel that way.
Right, yeah, I don't think so either. I think, you know, they're more impressed with his ability to have jumped into college hockey and be a top four defenseman at a top program. And I think by the end of the year, to me, watching Boston College, he was way ahead of Michael Matheson, a first-round pick, who's 3 years older than him, and Ian McCaughan. I mean, and those guys are great players, but I think once he got towards the end of that season, he was ahead of them. He's better defensively. He just did a lot of things better. And that's not really a knock on those guys so much as it is a compliment to Hanifin. I think that's why there are teams that are going to view him, especially you look at the Coyotes at third, and if they, you know, they see that they've got some young, you know, studs that can produce, like Domi and Duclair and the kid Christian Dvorak. So guys like that can come in and play, maybe not next year, but soon, they would look at a guy that they could potentially pair with Oliver Ekman-Larsson as early as next year, or a guy that could be that tandem defenseman where we've got our two cornerstone guys. So to me, you know, I don't know that I necessarily view Provorov as NHL ready. I know there are teams, I'm sure, that do. And I think that, to me, watching what Hanifin did and the progression throughout the year, and I look also back to Jacob Trouba's freshman year, and he was a year older, going from true freshman to the Winnipeg Jets and not really having much difficulty with the transition aside from injuries. I see a very similar future for Noah Hanifin, and I think he could be in the league next year, and I think he could be a pretty decent, you know, five or six next year, moving into the top four within a year or two. It just kind of depends on what teams need and what they have on their roster. But if it's a team like the Coyotes, they're not going to get any free agents, so they're going to need somebody.
No.
And it might have to be the number three pick.
Chris, with the speaking of both the Coyotes and to also to another extent the Toronto Maple Leafs, I know both teams have sort of certainly the Coyotes have let know that they're listening for potential offers for the third pick, and there has been some talk potentially Toronto might also be listening as well potentially for draft offers for the fourth pick. in your mind, with the level of depth in this draft, is it really, for teams who might be looking at that, is it, for this draft, is it too, what those teams may be offering may be too cost prohibitive for what they're going to want in return for those picks?
Well, I think for both of those teams, it's going to take a lot to pry them away. They're going to have to be blown away by the offers. And I think in the Coyotes' case, they need NHL-ready players, and they need another first-round draft pick out of the deal. That's not necessarily a price that teams are going to be willing to pay. It just depends, you know, if teams see obstacles to them picking a Hanifin or a Marner or Strom, you know, how much is it worth paying for those players? To me, I don't think Marner and Strom, or really even Hanifin, necessarily would be so good that they would pass up on them if the right trade opportunity came along. But, yeah, I mean, it just kind of depends what they're looking for. But both of those teams are kind of in a similar spot with Toronto needing to jettison some contracts possibly. You know, what can they give up or what can other teams give up to get that pick away from them? I think, personally, I doubt that the Maple Leafs will trade the fourth, and I don't think that Arizona is going to be too quick to move the third, but I think they would be more willing than Toronto would to move that pick because they're going to have so many decisions. So it's going to be interesting to see. But, like, when you look and you say, okay, there's a guy like Provorov, or there's a guy like Werenski, maybe I'll move on from Hanifin and take, you know, whatever I can get that's an NHL-ready player. But the Coyotes need to be thinking more about the long-term future instead of the short-term, because they got a long rebuild ahead of them.
Yeah, I was talking about this on another show this week, and I feel like if you're in the third or fourth, it would be okay to trade down if you got a lot, but I wouldn't want to trade it down more than, like, the 10th pick, because, you know, there's always going to be a difference in talent. Now, this is a deep draft, there's no question about it, but then you might be going from what could be a superstar to a star. And so you have to be careful about that. Now, if you just need spots filled, then I get it, because you'll get some really good players to fill spots. But, you know, the one thing I always notice about trades and the ones that you have to sort of do two for ones, three for ones, whatever, most of the time the teams that get the two or three players don't do as well as the team that gets the one, or that one.
Right.
But yet we see it all the time, right? Because sometimes they have to do it out of necessity. So it just seems like to me, if it's going to be Arizona, and I don't think Toronto would be against trading down, but I do think you're right. I think they would look for a king's ransom, but I don't think they would be willing to go like further down than 10. That's my feeling. I mean, somebody might do that, but I don't think anybody should. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that, and that really limits your market, right? So, you know, I think it'd be really hard to justify going any lower than 10, just because, you know, we see the names that are on the board, and it is deep, the first round's deep, but there is a gap. I think, you know, you've got your top two guys that everybody knows about, and there's even a gap between them. And then there's a gap between the three and the five and all that stuff. And then you go down to six, and it's an even bigger drop-off. So, yeah, I mean, I think that if you're in such a good spot, and you look at the projected top five for this draft, and it's outstanding. You know, so, yeah, I mean, and I just don't know if the teams that are that close to them, below them, are going to have anything that's really all that appetizing aside from the draft pick. So, you know, that's where it comes down to, you know, how big of a player are you going to give us in addition to the draft pick, or how are you also going to give us your first pick next year or a second rounder this year? So, I mean, there's so many ways that you can draw it up, but I just think it's this year the safest thing to do if you have a top five pick, keep it and just take those players and take the guy that's the first on your board and go from there.
Chris, I'm looking at, you know, some of the potential, you know, second round picks going into this draft. Are there any in your mind that potentially could a team with a first round pick could surprise and take earlier than expected? If there's any sort of a player that you would look at any rank level that could, where a team might be a surprise, where you might have a second round grade on them, but could end up getting taken in the first.
Yeah, well, I think the one guy that has, you know, been all over the map in terms of projection is Jeremy Bracco, and you know, I'm guessing you probably predicted I would say him, but he's you know, I always look at McKenzie's rankings and see, you know, that's one where I put a lot of stock into what's in there just because of the general consensus, and there were people that were picking Bracco as a first round talent, and then he's 53rd on Bob's list, and that really shocked me. You know, I thought that based on
I don't think
skill
enough
level,
people have seen him enough, Chris. I think that's the issue. I think people like you and me have seen him more because we're sort of keyed on him. But I don't think, like, when he's getting that general consensus, they've seen him enough.
Yeah, you know, it's strange. But, I mean, he had such a great under-18. And the other thing that's interesting, he played on the line with Austin Matthews for most of the year. They move him off. They put Jack Roslovic on that line. They got more balance in their lineup. Bracco still produced. He didn't produce.
He got points every game.
Yeah, he didn't. And he didn't necessarily have, like, the difference was he didn't have 4 points a game. You know, like he had a point every game. But, yeah, so he just, you know, is an assist machine. I personally would have taken him on the World Junior roster over a Miles Wood or somebody like that didn't have the skill level. And then we saw that when they couldn't score, and he would have helped. But he's a guy, to me, that has such dynamic skill. And I think I look at, like, the Lightning. If the Lightning, you know, they have their – they have the Rangers pick, right? So they're that's the one they held on to. So, like, that's a team where I'm like, okay, he's their kind of guy. Or, you know, teams like that put such a high emphasis on skill with their first-round picks, those are the ones that I think could potentially take him. And they'll be very happy with that pick. I think that his size has been knocked to a point where it doesn't make sense to me. He is undersized, but he's not Johnny Gaudreau small. And he makes plays. I mean, he's done it every year. He broke Patrick Kane's records. He's a kid to me that is getting a bit of a knock on him. And you know what the funny thing is, when I mentioned Roslovic earlier, he went from about a fourth round projection to a second round projection. And what changed?
Yeah.
He played with Austin Matthews for half the season, you know, so that's the difference. And that's kind of the way that you see that, how that works. You're looking at points, you're looking at things, and I just think for Bracco in particular, you just got to look at the skill and say, this is worth taking a risk on. If I don't even think it's that great of a risk.
I don't either. I want to tell listeners in about 2 minutes, the show will pop off, and we'll probably go into about 5 minutes overtime, and if they want to come back, they could listen to the rest. Yeah, I think Bracco goes early second. That's where I have in my rankings, but I'll tell you a dark horse for me, and I was the only one that spoke to him there, and that's Cooper Marody. And sometimes there's the bright stars that come out of the USHL, and they get all the attention, like a Kyle Connor. But then a guy like Marody, who was high in the rankings, sometimes could just sort of sink a little, even though he had a good year, and actually scored really well at the combine and like his recovery. And I think that's a key thing. He's a center. He's got good size. He really has great vision. I saw this guy as a face-off whiz. I mean, and I talked to him about it there, and so he's, like, well aware of that. And so, and to me, and you probably could concur on this, it's hard to find a prospect that's actually good at faceoffs right off the bat. So I think if I'm a team with a mid-second-round pick, I got to get this guy because he could be a second-line center.
Yeah, well, I think he's a guy that kind of – he's another one that's been a little bit over the map, and – you know, I didn't get a chance to watch the USHL as much as I had in years past just because of the NHL responsibilities I had. But, you know, he was on a championship team. You know, there's when you have a kid that's like that and you know, you like those winners and everything. And as you mentioned, he's good at certain skills that you know, may not be somebody his age is typically good at. You also like the fact that again, the championship caliber player, and he did produce extremely well for a draft eligible player. I thought that the draft
49 points, 38 games.
Exactly. Yeah. So I mean, you know, that's at the USHL level. You know, as a 17 or 18 year old kid, producing at that clip is really, really impressive, and that's what makes Kyle Connor so impressive as well.
Yeah.
They just did it against this league that is so good defensively, and that is a huge plus for any kid. And I think that USHL kids, typically get underrated, and they provide a pretty decent return when they hit. And I think that, you know, I don't know enough about Mary to say that he's going to hit, but you look at what he's done this season, and you certainly see a guy that's got a real good opportunity to go in the top two rounds, in the second round there. And I think that Central Scouting even rated him in that kind of range, if however much stock you want to put into that. But there's certainly guys there. Okay. Yeah. So there are guys there, and I think the league this year has some outstanding players.
A question for me to wrap up, and I know I mentioned I was going to ask you earlier about your views on the Flyers hiring of Dave Haxtell and how you feel, you know, how the transition will potentially go with him coming from college hockey to the NHL.
Yeah, well, I think with the transition is going to be the interesting part. I have all the faith in the world that it's going to go really well, and I think that he's going to have the respect of the players pretty quickly. I don't know necessarily if it'll be immediate, but I think that it won't take long for them to kind of get him and get his style. And I think they're going to like the way that he coaches and the way that he plays. He's kind of a hard-nosed guy. He's intense, really committed, a really smart hockey mind. So when you have a guy like that, it doesn't matter what level he came from or what he knows or doesn't know, or what you think he knows and doesn't know. He's going to, you know, command your respect. And I think even at the NHL level, players are going to respond to that.
I'm going to go with the last question for both of you guys, and I'll just make a statement about this year's Stanley Cup. We're really seeing like a war of attrition, and it is amazing with the close games. We haven't seen it this close in about 5 years, I guess it was. And every game is pretty much a goal, and it's like who's hurt, who's not, who could play this game, who can't play that game. And it's just, to me, it's sort of amazing because it just seems like period to period you could pick a different winner for the Stanley Cup, and we probably won't even know until like 2 minutes before whatever game ends, 6 or 7, and there's a champion. But Chris, that kind of makes it show what the NHL season does to players. It just grinds in the dust.
Yeah, it does, and I think that, you know, we've seen in these games where particularly the Lightning, they're the younger team, they're a little bit fresher, they're a little bit deeper, and they have those layers. And you know, when you can look and when you can dress 7 defensemen, and the 7th defenseman is Nikita Nesterov, who I think is going to be a stud for them in a couple of years, that's a pretty good problem to have. And then you look at the Blackhawks, and they're just trying to put the defense together with duct tape at this point. So, it is all about surviving. The difference between Chicago and Tampa, obviously, is the experience level for Chicago, which is their advantage, and they have their top end is a little bit better than Tampa's top end, even though their Tampa's is so good. So, I mean, it is amazing to me to watch this series and to see how close these two teams are. This is exactly what I expected it to be. I don't know if I expected it to be so low scoring, but I definitely thought that it would be very close, and it has been even closer than I think you could have possibly predicted. I think the NHL even said that this is the closest series in terms of margin of victory and all these other statistics since 1968. So, I mean, like, that's what we're talking about here, and it's been a great series to watch.
Ant, your last thought?
Yeah, I would agree with just everyone of Chris's thoughts there. Again, Tampa's just been, they've had ice water and they in their veins, and I don't know whether that's just that they're young and are just at a point where they can just sort of go and be able to, you know, plow past it. I think that game 7 win over the Rangers gave them enormous confidence. They went into there with enormous confidence. Nobody had ever, you know, the Rangers had never lost a game 7 at home in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel that they can pretty much beat anybody, and they have that confidence. That being said, Chicago, I've always said it in the past, you know, you have to put them out. You have to put them away. And, you know, Tampa had an opportunity in game four to potentially really gain a major advantage. And now we're locked at 2-2. And again, any chance that as Chris said, to be able to get off the mat and still have, you know, the belief that they can get by and still win. Again, it's been a fantastic series. You know, Brendan Saad's been just amazing. in terms of what he's been able to do. As Chris, Chris's colleague Adam Gretz said, he's set for major payday. I completely agree there. He's gonna make major bank in this offseason. So again, I have nothing. I mean, I said Chicago in six, but really, there's really nothing to separate the two. It's just gonna be who blinks first.
All right, guys. Well, listen, I appreciate it, and Chris, we'll catch you on CBS Sports, and Ant, we'll catch you at the NHL draft and all different places, and that's going to be another edition of Off the Post. We'll catch everybody next time.
Take care, everybody.
Thanks, guys.